And once you understand existence and observation and go through these different layers of learning logic and how to apply it to the structure we see as reality, it's a lot less chaotic. It's a lot more autonomous, which is what, you know, the ultimate history lesson is designed to do. It's designed to build a sense of autonomy, to give you a process to deal with chaos and confusion, because then you can be self-reliant and, you know, a thinking, conscious human being who's empathetic and compassionate, and you can escape the long-term indoctrination, and you can realize that anarchy and chaos are not synonyms.
Is there an idea more radical in the history of the human race than turning your children over to total strangers who you know nothing about, and having those strangers work on your child's mind out of your sight for a period of 12 years? Could there be a more radical idea than that? Back in colonial days in America, if you proposed that as an idea, they'd burn you at the stake, you mad person. It's a mad idea.
My guest today is Richard Grove from TragedyAndHope.com. He is also the host of the Peace Revolution podcast. And today we are going to be discussing a film that he has produced. It is called The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. And Gatto is, of course, no stranger to the audience of this show. We've been talking about him for over 2 years. First of all, Rich, how you doing?
I'm good, Brett. Thanks for inviting me back.
Yeah, no problem. Not like we haven't been talking for an hour already. But that's none of that's in the show. So I've been listening to the audio of the whole presentation here. You guys are breaking down the video on your podcast. I think you're doing them in hour segments, and then you talk for what, about 15 minutes? Or you do your interview with Gatto for about 15 minutes, and then you pause and you have a discussion group. And I just think that it's absolutely fascinating, and I've really gotten into it. I think I'm on the fourth part right now. So what can you tell us about this? Like, what motivated you to do this, and how did this all work?
Oh, that's a complex question. It could lead to hours of discussion.
Oh, man, I like open-ended questions. Sure.
First off, to reference what you were referencing, you're talking about Peace Revolution episodes 41 through 45.
Yep.
The intention was to take the footage that we had of Gatto, and it took a long time to post-produce it and get because it's a video. So we wanted to put the audio out as soon as possible to get people, you know, thinking about these things, provide all the references, and kind of build that out for ourselves as we continue to research it and understand it as a function of having learned so much through the process of producing that film. So what you're hearing is 15 minutes of the interview that took place here in the living room of our house, and then we discussed it for, the potential was 15 minutes, but some of the segments go quite a bit longer because the density of what John is laying out and the coherence and continuity of it all demands that we serve up the primary resources that he's talking about, make those available to you, go into these secondary resources or any other things that aren't being said directly but are really being said under the surface through context and through allusion, A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N, right? So reference to other historical events, which is why at some point, probably in the third hour when we're talking about the Bavarian Illuminati, he says it would take too many allusions to these various other pieces of rich history that we don't have time to talk about right now in order to truly understand this. And then he moves on to pragmatism, which isn't really a red herring. He's just saying, I see your move and I raise you one. Here's the current evolution and how it's affecting us directly through Harvard.
Yeah. And I think the interconnectivity between a lot of these different topics and areas and explorations and investigations is, it's really something. And I think a lot of people, they want to just kind of grab and yank the emergency brake when they hear things like Illuminati, Skull and Bones, and this picture of this sort of web of conspiracy. But you know, the thing that I really learned from listening to this is, like, the kinds of people who think that they are special enough to, and we're going back centuries, who think they're special enough to be this management class over human beings, that other human beings are basically animals on a farm. It's a small group of people, and whatever period of time and whatever place we're talking about, those kinds of people are probably going to be networked together. Those kinds of people seem to gravitate to each other.
Well, I mean, what I found was the root cause to almost every problem we have has to do with this indoctrination system, which is the main focus of the School Sucks podcast. Mm-hmm. What you find is that over thousands of years, the elite ruling class, the self-appointed ruling class, has decided to practice crowd control and manipulate and rule over the volitions of others. And so instead of having self-reliance as individuals, they induce a slave mentality, which is artificial. They also create a terrarium environment, which is also artificial, to make you subservient to the state by being totally reliant on it. And so all these isms through time are really the individual, you know, sacrifice of the individual for the benefit of the state. And that's the core of all the corruption that you've cited in your podcast, that we cite in the Ultimate History Lesson, as far as how it affects public education and public schooling. And really what you're seeing is, it's a documentary that says it's about public schooling, but really it applies to everybody. And it's kind of in disguise, because it's such volatile and potent information that if anybody sits down and actually pays attention and watches this, you have a contending power, because your mind is just as malleable as anyone else's. And if you form it yourself out of integrity and that which exists in a strong sense of epistemology and etiology to understand cause and effect through history and see these patterns for yourself, John goes through a great deal of time and study in his life and in the Ultimate History Lesson discussing how he proved this to himself, because he was a doubter. How did he overcome his doubts about these anomalies we come across? And then you see, they're not anomalies. There's a whole coherent picture if you connect these dots, and that's the real big picture that governs our world. And it's not like there's any ruling class that is directly in control of everybody.
Right.
It's really a philosophic corruption of our reality. Because if you took out any of those ruling class, the super class, David Rothkopf calls them, it's a CFR book. He calls them the super class. There's 6,000 individuals who are the elite ruling managerial class. Now, they're not really the top, but they're the ones he's willing to publish about, right? And if you took those people away magically, right, in a hypothetical scenario, other people have been groomed with the same philosophic corruption of reality that says there's no objective truth. Truth is what strong people make it up to be.
Mm-hmm. This is our friend Kant, by the way, right? That's where that comes from. Yeah, I think that Gatto's, the reason why I first heard of him, maybe at this point almost 10 years ago, was because of just this exhaustive research on how these ideologies from these Prussian intellectuals, our school system came from there. This is something that we've covered extensively on both of our shows. But I think his work is pretty much why... I mean, we could have found out about this eventually on our own, but his work is why that knowledge is so accessible today, the Prussia connection.
Well, I think it's what makes it understandable to people today to be able to to relate through the poetry of his words and describing these aspects. The fact that it exists, it's legible. You can understand it if you know it exists. No one's going to draw your attention to it. But if you start reading through these series of books and looking into these ideas for yourself, I'm not saying to believe what Brett or I are saying or what John Taylor Gatto says in his books. I'm just asking you to have the curiosity in your own life to ask the questions and start understanding how to find valid answers, because it's only through a process of learning and using reason that we can come to understand anything and make sense out of it. And I think it's evident through the evolution of history. You know, there's a lot of aspects of history that are horrifying and how people have been manipulated. But there's also these things that we have observed cause and effect. We have created inventions and tools, and we know how to replicate fire, and we don't have to fear the nighttime anymore. And we're able to build structures that don't fall down in the rain, and all these different fears that people had for years and years and years. We're now able to educate our way out of these things, right? And so right. There is a very legitimate presence of reason in survival and self-reliance and educating yourself to survive and thrive in this world. But when we are indoctrinated for 15,000 hours by a system that's created by our natural predators, it's then very logical, the reason that we're not taught in school, that we have natural predators. And that's really the root cause of their ruse.
Yeah, it's funny, too, how you talk about this historical evolution of letting go of these fears as, people gained more access to information. It's funny that so much of the propaganda that comes from the schools, that comes through the mainstream media and current events today, still seems to cater to these most primal instincts. Like, I think initially in society, people accepted leaders because, hey, you're part of the tribe, you're strong, we know you, we trust you. In times of crisis, we will defer to you for leadership. And we see today that most of the governments in the world, leaders thrive on fear. I don't want to call them leaders. Rulers thrive on fear. You know, that's what gives them their power.
Well, I think it's the primary example that people have been shown over and over again through time. I think it's the primary motive and operational sense of any news program or newspaper is that the solution is always violence. It's to create more prisons, put more people in jail, create more laws, fight more wars. It's any of these things, but it's not constructive, compassionate communication skills, right? It's not learning how to communicate based on a sense of logic and reason and, you know, a sense of how to observe and identify knowledge for yourself. So you know if somebody's trying to present you something that doesn't exist. That's the illusion. That's the fallacy. It's the cunning attempt to trick you through the use of words, and people lie through the use of words. They omit through your sense of your dependence on their sense of history as opposed to your own. And they do it through censorship. There's all these, as Clausewitz would say from the Prussian days, this is total war. They're not just fighting on a battlefield. It's undeclared against you. Like, the evidence is out there, but you have to find it for yourself. The war has been going on in your food and your air and your school and your everything, right? Like the clothing we get.
Sure, your media, absolutely.
Everything. Computers we're buying. It's like, why, if everyone had a sense of serenity, if they lacked the scarcity, the fear, all these other things that drive them to do inhumane things or to advocate war, right? In a world where people here in America are calm, cool, and collected because they're using a methodology to ascertain what existence is as juxtaposed to their sense of reality, right? That type of place, that's a hypothetical right now, but we're working toward it, would refuse to buy any type of material goods that come from places that have to have suicide nets outside to catch their employees from trying to get out of their job, right? Like, you know, what they do, it's not just China. It goes on all over the world. It goes on in our country. And I just think they can only do this by blocking off all these flows of information. And that what we try to do, whether it's through the School Socks podcast or Peace Revolution or the Ultimate History Lesson, is to reopen up those channels to let people know that cause and effect exists. You're here for a reason. As long as you breathe, you need liberty and you have these inherent rights as a living individual. And that's it. It doesn't belong to nationality or color. It's not on a piece of paper. It exists because you breathe. And once you understand existence and observation and go through these different layers of learning logic and how to apply it to the structure we see as reality, it's a lot less chaotic. It's a lot more autonomous, which is what, you know, the Ultimate History Lesson is designed to do. It's designed to build a sense of autonomy to give you a process to deal with chaos and confusion, because then you can be self-reliant and, you know, a thinking, conscious human being who's empathetic and compassionate, and you can escape the long-term indoctrination, and you can realize that anarchy and chaos are not synonyms.
Right.
But that's a change in definition that they've pulled, and that's what Gatto says. He says they change the definition on your words. That's how they take over.
And I think just to step back, before we go any further, just to step back to something you said a couple minutes ago about total war, and I think there's people who might listen to this and would say, guys, come on. Like, total war, this small group of James Bond villains waging total war on the world. Because I think for most people, they become incredulous about these things because there's so much of a distance between the way an ordinary person treats others and views others and the way that these people look down at humanity as inferior, irrational. A word that's used several times between you and Gatto is pests. He says that word several times, that the management of society is essentially, to them, a pest control, especially when people dissent or people question what's going on. So I think when people are so reluctant to look any closer at any of these things, and I haven't done a lot on my show as far as really getting into the context of this, but they fail to recognize that what might be at work here is an entirely different psychology. with this managerial class of people. So one of the things that comes up several times in your discussion that Gatto mentions is the concept of justified sinning. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Well, justified sinning is this concept that has existed for many thousands of years in various forms. And what you do in listening or watching the Ultimate History Lesson is you're exposed to, you know, it's not a continuous story, but it is a surprisingly coherent and rich fabric or texture of history that we haven't been, you know, able to see, right? We've been given a black and white education, to use a TV metaphor, and he's offering you something in high definition. And you can really almost, you know, it's almost 3D because it does come alive when you understand that there's this idea of the divine right of kings. That's been around since before the Bible.
Right.
And in order to ingratiate themselves to these various ruling powers, these alleged authorities, certain philosophers and thinkers of their times, and as a means to support themselves, would adopt sophisticated rhetoric techniques to provide words to the king that were useful in oppressing the masses. And the popular belief or philosophy has been through time is that the masses are inherently and genetically irrational, and there's nothing you can do to save them, so therefore they must be controlled like cattle. We are the evidence that we are conscious, and we are not to be treated as cattle, and we are each individuals with sovereign inherent rights of humanity. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't stop at an imaginary border, and just because you're an American, you have special rights that other people on the other side of the planet don't have to, you know, be afforded, right? As long as people are alive on this planet, logic and reason provides the evidence that you can go through and achieve a proof, and you can't have a proof without logic and reason as the underpinning on it, right? Mm-hmm. That would be the concept of the stolen fallacy, right? The idea that you can use logic or proof to prove something that doesn't stand up to the objective components of existence. So the idea is that this idea has precipitated through time that it's okay to take away other people's volition. It's okay to plan their lives, to sterilize them, to kill them, to drop nuclear bombs on them, to send, you know, some people's kids over to kill other people's kids while old men sit around and make a bunch of money. This is not new, but what is new is our ability to take all these points of history and use the internet and communication and organizational software to bring all these lines of evidence together to see the clear patterns. And so, as opposed to being frustrated like I was for years when people say, oh, that can't exist, or, you know, there's nothing I've been taught about that. Well, first, they're under the assumption that they were given the proper schooling. Mm-hmm. And even if you've gone to an Ivy League school, I had a caller on a show a couple weeks ago who was from, you know, went to an Ivy League college, and yet he found out all this important stuff outside of his education. I would point not only to Gatto, but to people like Anthony Sutton and people like Carol Quigley. And Quigley being a mentor to Rhodes Scholars like Bill Clinton, being a teacher, a professor at Georgetown University, Princeton, and Harvard, he's definitely representative of the establishment. And he spends 20 years putting together this book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, using exclusively Council on Foreign Relations, private records, Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is the UK version of the CFR, private records, personal stories from people who are in the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable and people continuing this legacy, etc. So it's not so much about Quigley being really cool or being great. Like, he's a guy. He has fallacies. He has blind spots. He has weaknesses. He has compromises. Whatever. He's a messenger.
Yeah.
The book itself. I don't claim that the book itself is this big tome of truth. What I see is the value of someone like Quigley making it known to the public that these things exist. Here's the conspiracy. Here's the proof. Here's the evidence. Here's all this stuff. It's not a theory. It's history. And so now how I see it is when people have those remarks, I say they've been using their habitual time to consume a bunch of things that are produced by their natural predators. They don't yet understand this. They haven't yet invested the time to see their blind spots and explore these areas. They're about to have a fantastic time actually getting, you know, their consciousness focused into cogitating reality and what's actually going on instead of going on the error-prone map that they've been provided to make them food for their predators, right? And so they're at the brink, and you just have to provide the right spark. They're already dried out enough through the system to take flame and really have some curiosity and to use that fire of the mind for themselves and not have someone else create a fire in your mind to control you. There's a famous book by James H. Billington, who was not only a Rhodes Scholar, but also was a Librarian of Congress. And he wrote this book called Fire in the Minds of Men. And this book has, when I came across Tragedy and Hope, I thought that this is a great book because there are several sections in this book that are just so damning to the ruling class that I can't believe that they let us really get our hands on it, right? But in studying further in James H. Billington's Fire in the Minds of Men, he's basically laying it out for the elite that, look, here's all the history and all the proof to all these things that you thought were a conspiracy theory. Here's the actual history. And it's written in such a way that it's so comprehensive and dense that if you just hand a single book to anybody who's looking for a good history book to read and seems like they've been deprived and they're suffering from malnutrition of facts and knowledge, this is a single book. It's still available. You can get it used. James H. Billington's Fire in the Minds of Men, The Origins of the Revolutionary Faith. He goes through all these different centuries of the use of things that are not true to control men of the age in order to light this fire of artificial revolution so that the ruling class could use what people perceive as revolution as the true building blocks of the culture being laid out by this other group that truly has and will continue to rule this planet until individuals each install the intellectual self-defense that we did a very diligent job of delivering through the ultimate history lesson.
And, you know, to go back again to something that you said a few minutes ago, as far as the whole predator-prey relationship is concerned, I think we want to point out, too, that we understand that there's more complexity to it than that. And in many ways, what we have going on here, in many respects, is a farm. Because my view of other human beings is not that, oh, wow, what a bunch of clowns and fools because they don't understand these things. Because if I look at some of the ways, like outside of the realm of where a lot of these conversations take place in the realm of politics, these people are doctors and engineers and, you know, they're successful in their family life. They're successful in their relationships. It was funny. Like I had this this guy kind of slam a door on me as I was walking out of a convenience store the other day. And he turns around. I'm holding a coffee. And he turns around and he goes, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry. I can't believe I did that. Now I have to do two good deeds for today. And then he got into his car. And as he drives away, I noticed that he has a Mitt Romney bumper sticker on the back of it. You know, so like I was like, wow, what a nice guy. And then as I see him driving away, I'm like, well, if that guy knew who I was, he'd probably want me dead. You know, in that realm of politics, everything changes so much. So this area, this arena is where people are invited to be this irrational, because in our private lives and our professional lives, we can't just live our 16 waking hours a day as these irrational beings just waiting to be led around for everything that we need to do. So it's like, getting people to focus in this political area, in everything that comes with it, the nationalism, the patriotism, when you're done being a producer for us largely, then you are kind of enslaved to this irrationality. You're not just on the farm, you have to produce, essentially.
You're not just on the farm, you have to help maintain the system that enslaves you.
Yes, exactly.
That's exactly what goes on. And I think, I don't find it beneficial to me to try to like disprove, debunk, to think of people as less than their potential, all these things. I don't find them useful, so I just don't incorporate them. So I see people as having this innate like genius and potential that if only non-government software was on their mind, right? If their operating system wasn't this conditioned, indoctrinated system, if they learned how to think for themselves and think freely, all these beautiful things would start to manifest such that when people ask us all the time, well, what's the solution? You've listed the problems. Hey, you always say that it's not the individual just because they notice the problem to offer the solution, right? Sometimes there's work that needs to be done by groups of people that bring all these things together and figure it out, right? But it also it takes away any responsibility from the individual to provide solutions when you're mentally deficient. I wanted to say that, but that's not the way I'll characterize it. When you haven't yet had the opportunity to be exposed to that which could exist. So in the case of people supporting Romney, that sounds great because all they've been exposed to is the noise. They think mm-hmm. the noise is great. The noise is everywhere. The noise is consistent. The noise is on their bumper sticker. I mean, if you'd caught them earlier, that could have been the first good deed, is stop trying to propagandize other people into like your mental compartment. Because when you get down to what are the qualifications of someone who needs to lead 300 million people, Mitt Romney doesn't meet any of our qualifications and should not be considered as a candidate. The debates are fake. The voting's fake. I haven't yet been convinced how someone else who I've never met, who's never met me, who doesn't consider my concerns, can make better decisions for me than I can. I'm unconvinced on that, right? And so it's the belief in these things that are not true, whether it's this belief in authority that's gone on for thousands of years. What's the empirical evidence that that belief works? Well, the Skinner experiment, Pavlov's experiments, Zimbardo, Milner, right? All these different things that you're not really taught about in public school, and there's a good reason why, because they're using those techniques to teach you in school.
Oh, yeah, geez, right? No kidding. Like this chapter is Skinner, and then the next chapter is how we applied it to the management of you. Yeah, that doesn't happen. So interesting time for a transition here on that note to another thing that you and Gatto talk about extensively in the interview is Fabian socialism. And I'd like to get a definition, because I'm thinking that this might be a new term to a lot of the people who listen to my show. But I think that this is kind of the direction that we're headed. Not we as a society, but like we, you and me,
it's
in this conversation.
Yeah. Okay. So I would start with the logo of the Fabian socialists. Their logo, if you look it up on Google Images, there's several. There's some stained glass imagery, which is very fascinating, which shows them pounding out and amending the earth, right? Mm-hmm. And then the logo itself is a wolf in sheep's clothing. So right there in their symbolry for the group, they're gleefully telling you that they are wolves in sheep's clothing, right? So they provide this perspective that is an adaptation of socialism that allows the elites to maintain governorship over everyone else who's basically been restricted. And it's their dream class. Now, Fabian socialism, you could say it originated in England formally as a group, but the people who participated were pan-European and transatlantic. So you had people in America, you had people in Britain, you had people in Europe who were all supporting these ideas, because what you see is an internationalist philosophy that these people had all outgrown nationalism and individual rights, and they saw themselves as the owners of the cattle ranch, and thus they start to act accordingly. So they lay down these beliefs, these systems of crowd control. They create, there's London School of Economics, Reuters, there's a lot of Rothschild banking involvement in the creation of all these things. It's all factual. You can go and find this. We've mapped it out. It's all on the site, tragedyandhope.com, under the brain. You can see a visual mapping of all this. So just search the keywords if you want to satiate your curiosity. And what you find is that the Fabian socialists included people like George Orwell in his early years, before he, kind of got disgusted with the plan and was on his deathbed and was like, hey, let me lay out some evidence for people and they can take it for what it is. But it was a description of how to manage people, much like Brave New World, but a dystopia of another variety, right?
Yeah,
so utopia, dystopia, these are all descriptions of nowhere. They're not here, but they're all based on the idea of this ruling class. It comes from Plato and Plato's Republic. So there's a lot to be learned from the Fabian socialists, because they also tie closely to the theosophists, which was a merging of, trying to create a one-world religion that would likewise support this elite ruling class. And H.G. Wells wrote several books. There's just not one. There's the New Machiavelli's. There's the New World Order. There's Things to Come in 1936 by H.G. Wells.
Yeah. Another thing I want to point out real quick, and I don't want to derail you completely, but as far as Orwell and Aldous Huxley are concerned, the only reason, if you're a student, the only reason why you might have heard of these people prior to the age of 18, in other words, you were exposed to these books as required reading in high school, is because these books were brought into the public schools, I think mostly in the 60s and 70s. Orwell, who was a socialist, was very critical of what ultimately happened to socialism in the Soviet Union, in the 19-teens and the 1920s, and obviously right up through most of the 20th century. The books were accepted into the English literature classes in school because they were seen as criticism of communism. We now see that, as they ring a little bit more true for our society, that books like Brave New World, 1984, and Animal Farm are actually disappearing from our schools.
Well, it's interesting because the animated version of Animal Farm was done by the Central Intelligence Agency and Ford Foundation, right? So what you have is, it's like Fahrenheit 451, right? People want to burn that book now. And it's a book about, why it's irrational to burn books. And it was shortly after reading Lark and Rose's book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, that I ordered a copy from Larkin and had him sign it to Ray Bradbury. And that is in California, and I can't wait to hear what George Clayton Johnson and Ray Bradbury have to think about this book, because as people who write science fiction and trying to foretell the future and who are equally involved in libertopia and these ideas of a science of volition, a science of free will, right, and a voluntary society, it's interesting to see that 50 years ago, what Bradbury's talking about in Fahrenheit 451, well, they're actually doing that now. They're disappearing these books. They took 1984. They disappeared it from censored it. They destroyed it through Apple's Amazon's Kindle, burning books. Right? That's what you use the Kindle. They use the books.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just the irony is getting too thick. I almost don't believe. I keep waiting for Alan Funt to like show out and be like, you know, hey, candid camera. Because it's just like all I see outside is irrationality. I'm like, no one else is getting this, really. And we need to find the others who do get this. And we need to spread the reason around liberally and really get people to think about this. And I think, like, you know, I prepared for weeks before we shot the Ultimate History Lesson, which is shot over 2 days. So that five hours of footage is basically untouched. Like, I put the different camera angles in there, but you're seeing a continuous, cogent conversation that doesn't have any scripting. I threw the outline away before we did it because we realized it was too much to do and not necessary, and it was a distraction. So I just took it off my desk. We have a conversation, and what he's laying out is what he's learned over his life and describing, you know, I think hours 3, 4, and 5 are the best, but you need to listen to hours 1 and 2 to get the context, right?
Yeah.
You can get some value out of it definitely by watching it out of order. But if you watch the whole thing continuously, at the end, you're left with beyond reasonable doubt, beyond plausible denial that these things exist, that this ruling class exists, that they are very advanced, that they use words and psychology and science and every tool at their disposal to try to manage us very much like animals. And they're, you know, the same way that they tag and track animals, they're doing that now. Implicitly through Facebook and Google, and soon to be explicitly through all these chips they want to embed in people through VeriChip and whatnot.
Or in things that people carry.
Right, because that's the next best thing, is to track everything that's on you so that there's, you know, 13 points of certainty that it was you in this location that they want to blame for whatever. So you just have – and if the public is too smart to believe that and they think critically and they're too hard to convince and they don't believe things easily – mm-hmm. Then that's great. That's great for everyone's sovereignty and volition and your free will and to get along and be voluntary and cooperate with everybody. That's cool. But when they make it such that, you know, everything's controlled beyond your free will and they create definite boundaries that are there to take away, your excess energy, whether it's the taxing system or any of these other things that are designed to drain you of your useful energy, even just trying to go through the newspaper or watching TV. That's a draining experience. You know, they just have you there so you'll watch the commercials. So it's all a bait and switch from the get-go.
Well, geez, even if you're talking about these things, like as far as VeriChip is concerned, and they sound incredibly far-fetched, people should still be able to recognize, like, at the very least, a trajectory, you know? As much as it's trajectory, as far as, like, how this stuff has ramped up, really, we've seen it accelerate, I think, in the last... 10 or 12 years, it's not like it was non-existent before that. And I was saying to, I don't know if I said this on the air or not, but I was talking to a couple guys when we were doing our live show a couple weeks ago. And I want people to understand that as bad as things seem now, it's not like the mentality of the ruling class was ever very different. And I think the example that I used was, imagine the Alex Jones radio show during the Woodrow Wilson administration. You know, I mean, that this is it, folks. It's over. You know, this is the end of America. This guy, what he's doing, you know, I mean, it wasn't any different then. But I don't think
there are differences. I could help you. I could see the comparison and see all the similarities that you're noticing.
Yeah.
But I could definitely draw the distinctions that
sure.
People are giving away a lot more of their energy and power and money today than they ever would have done in the past, because it would have taken too much convincing in the past. But after generations of indoctrination and Coca-Cola culture, let's call it, all these things have built up so that people will just sign up and agree, and it doesn't matter if you track all this stuff. And the whole thing where Google is just saying, hey, we're going to consolidate all these different privacy things, and you don't really have a choice. You don't. Like, I went in and deleted my information or whatever that's good for, right? I don't hold any illusions that anything I do anywhere really is private, because they've got everything everywhere. So whatever. I can't fight all those battles. What I can do is make sure that people know, hey, logic and reason, taken out of your schools for a reason. Frederick Douglass says the key to making a slave is to take away their ability to reason and identify contradictions. And I know that what you're doing here in the last couple episodes, next couple episodes as well, is to introduce this idea of fallacies. And I think you did a good job defining it in the last episode that I heard, where you're basically saying it's a, you know, it's a way that people are using words to trick or deceive you. That it comes from the Latin word fallere, to deceive. Mm-hmm. So there's two reasons that people use fallacies. They either are unwitting to having a method of proper thinking, or they know very well what proper thinking is and seek to, you know, get outside of that. In either case, it's not an information source that's valid for you. One person you can try to help, and the other person doesn't want to be helped. They want to domineer. And it's important to discern between those two types of people who might use fallacies or irrationalities, right? I could unintentionally use a fallacy, but it's not necessarily because I'm trying to deceive you so much as sometimes I don't think what I'm saying, so, you know, before I say it, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we have to keep it real and recognize that we're always talking about individual human beings, right? Like this whole propaganda that went on in World War I to dehumanize the Germans, you know, and there was a lot of German population in America at that time, so it was a tricky thing to do. But the way they do it is a very systematic way, and you have to consider, you know, it's a glittering generality, or it's a fallacy of generalization when you blame a whole country for the actions of a few people who are being funded by these other people who are actually here in the United States and Britain, by the way. Mm-hmm. Right. That's Anthony Sutton's work, where he's connecting not only the Cold War being funded by Western powers, but, you know, all these other groups and organizations that have had international influence, and people blame it as a national influence. And the problem there, the distinction that needs to be drawn, is the difference between interpolation and extrapolation. Now, interpolation is when you're taking that which exists, this knowledge or evidence or primary sources, and you're connecting those dots. That's reliable information. It's coming with a high degree of certainty. The other form is extrapolation, where you're taking what's given, and that may or may not be knowledge, and you're guessing as to the future. Now, that guesswork depends highly on the certainty level of that which you're extrapolating from, but extrapolation, nonetheless, is kind of guesswork. And people too often fail to demand that it be clarified. Are you interpolating or are you extrapolating? Right?
Right.
It's just like when you brought up the use of equivocation by Romney. I remember reading that a couple months ago. It's in the great books of the Western world. It's Aristotle's Organon, and it's in the first paragraph. He starts out by talking about equivocation, and univocation. So it's the word meaning one thing or the word meaning many things, right? Because vocation is to do some sort of work verbally.
Yeah.
Right? So it's doing more work when Romney uses we as an equivocation to pertain to all these different things. He means the government, he means you, he means them, and he's not defining. And that's where, you know, people should mentally resist. I think that's the most important thing we can learn. Once you become aware, you mentally resist, and you feed that mental resistance into learning what actually exists, because you'll find that the root cause of all our problems is, A, we don't understand the problems, we don't have the knowledge necessary to show us the solution, and B, we believe in things that are not true. We believe in things that do not exist, and the sooner we can identify that which exists versus that which does not exist, the sooner we all have the lost tools of learning back within ourselves to be autonomous, to be responsible, self-reliant human beings.
One part about this, and obviously we're going to tell people how they can get a copy of The Ultimate History Lesson and where they can hear it, where they can see it. But, you know, you're talking a little bit with later on in the discussion about how do we learn our way out of this. And he talks about change coming from the fringes, but in his case, I think he's talking about back in the day, so the fringes being more geographically, where if people were 20 miles outside of the center of town, nobody was coming out there to check on them. And then as the state or the lust and hunger and drunkenness on power grew and people would start showing up, there would be this immediate resistance. Like, we don't consent to the rule of strangers. We don't need anything from you. We are self-reliant. And, you know, today the fringes are not geographic anymore, But I think that at least in the circles where I am, I see people making a constant effort to be self-reliant financially, professionally, intellectually, of course. What's the expression, root hog or die? Is that it?
When he said that, I didn't really get it at first, right? So I didn't even really notice it during the live interview. But when I'm editing it, I heard it many times. And so I finally looked it up and I did the research. Root hog or die was a colloquial saying of 19th century America, like 1840s, 1850s, which pertained in its origin to having to set a hog free, and it's no longer going to be fed by the rancher. And so the idea is root hog or you'll die. If you don't root for your own food, you're going to die. But in the research of that, I found a very interesting usurpation. Is that the word?
Yeah.
These guys usurped it. Herbert Spencer and these other eugenicists then turned it to their use. So they take a popular phrase. It's, you know, it's just the same thing they do today with the Tea Party or any of these other things that might have humble origins, but then turn into tools of the state, right?
Yeah.
And so root hog or die was just this fascinating way of me continuing to remind myself that we're not the first ones to learn this. We're just the first ones to be able to make our own media at this level. And I think that's part of the solution is that as we go through and verify this for ourselves and we find all these useful artifacts, why not just share them with everybody as freely as we can afford to do? And, you know, I would say a very small percentage of the people who actually tune in and listen are the ones who financially support, you know, any of our independent groups, whether it's yourself or Jan at Gnostic Media or Corbett Report, right? So it's many hands make light work. So we can't do this by ourselves. And yet there's a larger audience that has yet to really be convinced enough to reprioritize some of their time and their habitual efforts towards something that they say that they see, you know, pays consistent rewards in the form of wisdom that's useful in surviving, right?
Yeah.
And so the thing that we had thought to do for the ultimate history lesson as far as what can we do to help other people who are doing commercial free educational media that are trying to address these problems that all these other people who are supposed to be responsible authorities, they're actually the creators of those problems. And so we have to take the responsibility among ourselves and do what we can. Creating media is the step we're at right now. But a long time ago, what did we have to do? We had to consume media. We had to go through the process of learning and doing our own fact checking, right?
Yeah.
So what we did with the Ultimate History Lesson is we put together the five-hour interview onto four DVDs or one Blu-ray disc, if you're high tech like that, and we created this thing called a research bonus pack, where we're basically giving you $140 of value for the $55 price of the DVD set, and we're donating $15 of each sale of this research bonus pack to the independent commercial free affiliate of Tragedy and Hope. In this case, it would be School Sucks Podcast. So I gave you those banners. If you put those banners up, people see that it clicks to the research bonus pack. It's got a coupon code there. They just enter that in, and then we make a donation to keep School Sucks independent and growing and thriving. We send a portion of any of the DVDs to John Taylor Gatto to keep his projects going. And what you're getting for yourself is something that you literally cannot buy anywhere else. They don't sell it in any store. It's the thing that everyone wants to keep away from you because it's the single thing that we've seen can catalyze potential of any age. Whether you're, you know, if you have kids that are as young as 8 or 9 years old, they can find this interesting. If you've got a parent or grandparent that's in their 80s or 90s, they can find this interesting. And more than interesting, you can find it useful. So you can watch it over a week, 1 hour a day, or you could watch it over a year and look up every footnote and all these primary references. In short, it's a way that you can educate yourself beyond collegiate level for, you know, almost no money. And so what we're really doing is offering these lost tools of learning and all this potent information that is your birthright, that is your inheritance, that they have to take away from you to control you. And we're trying to get it out to as many people as possible in as many forms as possible.
Yeah. And, you know, it really is like the perfect media project for a web community that's named after a book that had its printing plates destroyed, you know? I mean, there's so much depth to this just from, and I encourage people to, you know, buy the DVD, but then also go and hear those. What did you say? It starts around 40, Rich, episode 40 of Peace Revolution.
Yeah, there's a couple different ways. So for those of you of means and that are employed or have some extra money and you want to get the DVD set because the internet's not always going to be around and you want to see it in HD or just have it, you know, for your own family archives, that's great. Thank you for helping us out. And now to the people who may have felt a little disenfranchised, let me just say this. PeaceRevolution.org, episodes 41 through 45, there's over 16 hours of the ultimate history lesson with analysis, with 1,000 footnotes that are clickable, and you can learn this all for no money. I've also put the entire thing up on YouTube, so you can watch the 5 hours in crystal clear 1080p HD. And, you know, the idea was to get it out there and not exclude anybody on the basis of money, because this information needs to be, it's everybody's right. So, you know, it wouldn't be the right thing to withhold it. So we put it out there for free. There's even a torrent. If you're into torrents, you can download the whole thing and help to spread it to other people. So I very much encourage people sharing it after consuming it. But we just wanted to take away all the resistance, like all the barriers that would keep people from actually digging in and take away all their potential excuses. Because really, right, what you're doing is like selling yourself short when you make an excuse before you look, you know, before you even examine something and see if it's valuable. And, you know, if you listen to what Brett has to say over the body of his whole School Sucks podcast, this is very much applicable. And it's not just applicable to the people in the audience who I would say are the choir. It's also a useful tool that you can use to get through to the proverbial congregation and use to communicate with your friends and family and coworkers in such a way that is credible. It's legible. In other words, you can consume it and you can understand it. But if you want to dig deeper and find more meaning, it's infinitely dense.
Awesome. So you and I are going to reconvene tomorrow, and we're going to get into we're going to introduce logical fallacies and talk about in more depth the importance. I know we covered a lot of that stuff today, but I'm off to meet a couple friends. We are going to do a voiceover on a machinima. You know what a machinima is?
I don't.
It's a movie that's made out of a video game, like using footage from video games.
Oh, and, right on.
Yep. So Stephanie Murphy, who I've worked with a lot in the past, she's been on my show and I've been on hers, who has a great voice, by the way, is going to do voiceovers for this little machinima using, I think the game is called Skyrim or something. I don't know anything about video games. But something that my girlfriend put together, it's a short machinima about how much it sucked to be a serf because they had to give a small percentage, I think in this example, 10% of their productivity over to the Lord. So
yeah.
that must have been tough being a serf. So,
well, good luck with that tonight, and I look forward to our discussion, our continued discussion tomorrow evening.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Brett, and thank you everyone for listening.
So now the cap is off the tunnel to hell. Because not only are people justified in setting up a form of schooling that's anti-educational, but they're doing either nature's work or the Lord's work. You decide. You want to go Calvin, you're doing the Lord's work. You want to go nature, you go
Spinoza.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, all of this wonderfully rich fabric of foundation is right on the surface. Someone has to point your attention to it. Please, no one watching say, oh, this fellow Gatto is spun off, you know, this phenomenal, interesting, but wacky theory. I didn't spin off anything. I took the dots and I connected them. And I said, they're identical from 300 BC until post-Darwin Galton comes a German, a Prussian psychophysicist named Wilhelm Wundt, who is the premier behavioral psychologist on Earth. And now let me spring a bombshell on all of you. The only place in the world for a long, long time you could get a PhD degree was either Prussia, University of Berlin, Leipzig, these little nests of Germanic countries. So from all over the world came the sons of the most powerful families, beginning in 1814 or 16 in the United States, when the guy who later became the governor of Massachusetts went over to get his PhD degree. by the 1870s, 1880s, was a flood from Japan, from Russia, from everywhere. And now they return to their home countries, not because they have a PhD degree or they made presidents of universities, heads of government bureaus, because their families have clout. And now that's become the ticket to intellectual management.